You are listening to episode 4 of season 13 for 2019. I, of course, remind you, dear listener, that I'm no longer using months and weeks and things like that, days of the week even. It's all numbered days and year from now on. And actually, upon further thought, I realized I probably shouldn't even say 2019. I should probably go 2019.20. That would even be better, right? So 100% of any given year is 0.365, and therefore if you say 2019.20 or 2019.27 or 2019. I'd have to look up the calendar, but I mean any number would do, I guess, 100, then you are defining how far along the year. So that's perfect. It's a beautiful system. I'm very proud of myself for deciding to switch to this method of calendaring. So anyway, you're listening to The New World Order, everyone. I'm Classy High. In this episode, we're going to talk about ZFS one more time. Why? Because I finally installed ZFS. And I will guide you on how to do that yourself. Not that I'm a worthy guide at all. I have used it all of maybe 15 minutes so far. But I'm a firm believer in just getting into the water, as it were. You know, you can kind of poke around at the water, on the edge of the water. I'm in New Zealand, it's the summer. I'm making beach analogies. Apologies. You can kind of get close to it, but I mean, sometimes you just have to jump in order to kind of get over that procrastination or hesitation or whatever it is. So we're going to cover that today. I'm going to take a quick look at the two packages that start with R in the package set A of Slackware. And then maybe I'll get to other topics. We shall see. Let's get started. Let's not waste any time. ZFS, talked about it in the past, I don't know, 20 episodes so far, and I've finally gotten around to installing it. It was not difficult, and that's kind of what I want to say in this episode, that if you are thinking, as I wasn't, about installing ZFS, and then someone starts bugging you about, hey, you should install and try ZFS on Linux, then you know what? Why not? You should try it. It's not actually that difficult to install. There's a project, as you probably have caught on by now, called ZFS-on-Linux, or ZOL, and apparently it is doing enough good work that I think the story was that FreeBSD is going to rebase their work of getting ZFS on or of having ZFS on BSD to the same code base as ZOL. And then I think I also read somewhere that OpenVINDA was going to do the same, but that doesn't really make sense. But maybe. Maybe. Like I said before, OpenVINDA is keen, as far as I can tell, to get rid of the CDDL licensed software, so I wouldn't be surprised. Either way, ZFS on Linux is apparently a pretty good project. People seem to be happy with it, and it makes getting ZFS at least compatibility onto your Linux box. So I have not, for instance, done the drastic thing and wiped my entire hard drive and reinstalled and I'm not running a ZFS home directory or anything like that. That would be neat, but I'm not, as I said last week, I think I'm off to a conference in a week, and then I'm off to somewhere else in about 2 weeks. I can't afford to be messing around with computers right now. So, sort of jeopardizing the sort of workability of my computers. So not doing that. But I figured, well, I should at least put ZFS on the computer, and that way I can start maybe using ZFS on a thumb drive, and that could be the bridge between my Linux box and my OpenVINDA partition on my laptop. That seems useful to me. So I sat down at my Slackware box, as one does, and did a search through slackbuilds.org. Now, I use my own little custom tool called Sport, or Slackport, and it's sort of a little port-like tool. I like to think of it as that. And so I'll do a search, Sport S ZFS, and that returns that there is a ZFS-related package called in the system category of slackbuilds.org, ZFS-on-Linux. So I will do a sport cat ZFS-on-Linux to see the README files. And it tells me that it requires the SPL Solaris package to be installed before installing this. So I'm going to do a cat on SPL Solaris. And it says that the Solaris porting layer, SPL, is a Linux kernel module which provides many of the Solaris kernel APIs. This shim layer makes it possible to run Solaris kernel code in the Linux kernel with relatively minimal modification. This can be particularly useful when you want to track upstream Solaris development closely and do not want the overhead of maintaining a large patch which converts Solaris primitives to Linux primitives. Well, I wouldn't know how to do that anyway, so it's convenient. You need this if you want to run ZFS on Linux. Okay, well, there's that. That's the part that we care about, I guess. It says, note, you'll need the kernel source code to be able to compile this. The package is kernel dependent, so you must recompile it every time a new kernel if you install a new kernel, then you have to recompile this. If you're building this for a kernel that isn't currently running, you'll need to pass that kernel's uname-r output. Okay, so yeah, so there are ways around it, and that's great. So this little SLAP build is provided by Marcin Szczesowski, and it's really fantastic that he's maintaining this, and it's super easy to install. You just do, or what I do is I sport install spl-solaris space zfs-on Linux, and presumably your distribution has some kind of related command. Maybe it's a dnf install zfs-on-linux, or maybe it's apt-get or whatever. So whatever your command of choice is, that's how you get this on there, and it'll either install binaries that are matched up to your current environment, or it will look at your environment and build based upon it, which is what I have going on here. So once it's installed, I just kind of took a guess. I really just took it was a complete stab in the dark. I just thought, shot in the dark. Yeah. I just figured, well, it's a kernel thing, so I'm gonna guess it's a mod probe ZFS. And yes, it is. So then if you do an ls mod and then pipe that to grep ZFS, I'm gonna do that insensitively, case insensitive. So ZFS, Z Unicode, ZAVL, ICP, Z common, Z in V pair, ZFS common, Z common. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that I've just listed for you running, and then those are all grouped together under the SPL module. So those are the things that you need to kind of have churning in the background so that the rest of anything that you do with ZFS works. The way I sort of figured out, I guess, how to do this ZFS thing, first thing, again, just kind of guessing, I figured, well, makefs.zfs, right? And then nope. So, okay, well, let's just look at makefs and see what, maybe it's like something weird, like Z something. So I looked in, you know, just kind of tabbed complete makefs, and there's just nothing there that looks vaguely ZFS related. So I thought, okay, well, that's not good. So I looked in my packages, my var log packages, and then ZFS-on Linux, and sort of scrolled through, and that, for if you're not running Slackware, that is, FYI, the place where it records one line, one string per, you know, one entry per line. It records what exactly was installed with every package. So there's no weird rpm-ql kind of incantation that you need to understand what's been installed on your system. You just do a less on /var/log/packages, and there's a full list. And it's a pretty respectable list. There's a lot of stuff that got installed, but the stuff that we care about as users, I reckon, are in either a bin or an sbin folder. Here they are, they're in sbin. So they're administrative types of commands. A normal person wouldn't be using these. And those are, or a normal person could, but they would have to use sudo or su permissions to do that. So, well, su isn't really a permission, it's switching who you're running as. But anyway, they're privileged, is what I'm trying to say. And there's about 8 of them. There's fsck.zfs, so that's a file system check for ZFS. That's always good. I said, I think in the past episode, the fact that UDF didn't have that always made me nervous. There's mount.zfs, it's probably useful. ZDB, Z, literal Z, ZED, ZFS, ZHack, ZInject, ZPIOS, ZPull, ZStreamDump, and ZTest. So those are the sort of the user-facing more or less commands. Okay, so none of those told me really how to make a file system. And that was a little bit more complex, and for that, I turned to the man page. And unfortunately, I've got to admit, the man page I gotta say, it wasn't super useful to me in this respect, but that was, I think, partly because I was looking very specifically for, the incantation of MKFS. That's what I was looking for, right? And in my mind, it was very much, it had to be a device node, because I wanted to do this onto a thumb drive. So I did man ZFS, and if I look up, for instance, device, there are a couple of mentions of devices, but there wasn't really ever any kind of explicit sort of like, here's how you define the device, which I thought was kind of strange. And it I searched for just slash dev, and there's no mention of slash dev. So yeah, it was a little bit non-helpful. And so I scrolled all the way down to the bottom, because sometimes that is useful. Scroll all the way down to the bottom and look for examples. And there were some examples. There are about 8 or 7 examples. And it starts out with creating a ZFS file system hierarchy. That's cool. So it's ZFS create pool slash home. ZFS set mount point equal export home pool home. ZFS create pool home bob. So that seems useful, except there's this very important sort of thing missing, which is, where is this mount point, or this pool that we're creating, or whatever it is, where is that located? I just couldn't figure out how to define the actual device that I wanted to create this on. I didn't want to screw anything up and accidentally, I don't know, create some, create a ZFS partition on my main hard drive on accident. As I would have, I found out later that it would have warned me if I'd tried to do that. So enough about what I did and couldn't figure out. The answer, the ultimate answer, is a little bit different. So this is, again, specifically for a USB drive. So I guess if you're doing this all natively on a ZFS drive, then you can just create a pool. It's not a big deal. But since we're redefining sort of the root file system, it is a little bit different. The process is a little bit different. And that process is zpool, that's ZPOOL, space create, and then some name of the pool that you want to create. So if you remember my talk, or our coverage of the LVM set, that tool set, then you'll kind of remember something about how you made a storage pool, and then you could throw storage into that pool, and so on, right? So this is kind of creating a pool and giving it space all within one command. So zpool space create space ZFS stick, that's what I called it because it's a USB stick, and then space slash dev slash SDX1, where SDX is, of course, the device that you have plugged into your computer, and that you've confirmed that that's the location, and that you know that that's what you want to use as your storage device. Okay, so when I did that, it came back with, hey, you can't do that because there's a file system on that drive. Now, I happened to know that there was a file system on that drive, and I happened not to care. So I used the dash F, probably for force, as it told me to do, to create the ZFS files, the pool on that device anyway. And it did that. And I think it just kind of, it did that silently. And that was sort of the end of our transaction together, me and Zpool. So the next thing that I didn't know, what to do, was how to now find what I had just accomplished. So I went up into my device, the device notifier thing in KDE, and tried to mount the drive in the file manager, and it didn't let me do that. It just kind of ignored me. So the GUI ignored me. I mean, it didn't give me any kind of error. It just acted as if I'd never clicked on it before, at all. So I turned back to the man page, and it turns out there's this command called ZFS space list, and that lists all of the Z pools, the storage pools that ZFS, the sort of the ZFS subsystem, if you will, running in the background, is aware of. And it tells me, sure enough, there's the name ZFS stick used as a full, a whopping 344 kilobytes. And I know what that 344 kilobytes is because I put a little photo in the thumb drive just to have copied a file somewhere. Available at 57.6 gigabytes. It's a pretty big thumb drive, I reckon. I mean, sort of. I mean, you know, you see 8 gig, you see 64 gig. 64 is pretty big thumb drive. Refer 283 kilobytes, mount point slash ZFS stick. Ah, okay, so if we go to ls slash ZFS stick, sure enough, that's where the device is. So after I created the pool, it was automatically mounted at my root partition with the name of the pool that I had provided it. Now, I could have overridden that setting with the mount point option, but I didn't do that. I didn't know to do that. Didn't really need to do that. So I'm fine with just mounting things as slash ZFS. I guess in the future, I could override that, and I could maybe set up a ZFS configuration file, maybe. I'm not really sure what that would go into it, and have it mounted under the slash media directory, or the slash MNT directory, and so on. So you can open up your file manager, whatever you use. I use Dolphin, so if I open that up, and I have my locations kind of editable, so I can just click right in there and just type in slash ZFS, and it auto-completes it, figures out that I'm talking about the one place on my system that starts with slash Z, and there it is, this empty space. Now, it's got a little icon up in the left corner for me telling me, hey, this is owned by root, so this is kind of a weird place for you in user land to be, and that's okay. So I figured it was probably going to be a little bit restricted, that area, so I tried to drag just a little piece of art that I downloaded from the internet at one point or another into the drive, and sure enough, it told me I couldn't do that. That was not, permission was denied, access denied, could not write to slash ZFS. So back in the terminal as root, I said make dir slash ZFS stick, and then I'll just stash, and then what would it be, chmod, let's do just for now, chmod 777 slash ZFS stick stash. And that, now that's writable by everyone. And so I can put little artworks in there, and there you go, works. So that's my experience so far with ZFS. Am I in love with it? Well, not yet. I just got started, but I am eager to try ZFS, to kind of give it the old college try, really, to see how it does, because I have high hopes. I hear a lot of good things about it. I'm not necessarily, as I've said before, I'm not necessarily looking for a replacement for things like ext4, but if I do have, if ZFS is going to be the universal file system like VulcanWriter promised me in the previous episode, then I'm on board. I'm ready for this. So I am eager to start using this in earnest. So thanks, DeepGeek. Thanks, VulcanWriter, and thanks anyone else who I've probably forgotten. Maybe Cobra 2. Cobra 2 bugs me about a lot of things, all of which are good and have mostly all changed my life. But yeah, like, thank you to the people who have kind of prodded me into trying ZFS. I appreciate that. And I urge you, dear listener, to give it a shot. I mean, at least install it on your system, just like you would install support for NTFS or XFAT or JFS or anything else. Just install it. Get it on the system so that if you encounter a ZFS thumb drive, you can plug it into your computer and it will be recognized. Like, that much, you owe yourself that much, if nothing else. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to try all these fancy snapshots and things like that. But that's data that I have yet to gather, so it's a topic for a later episode. Let's go get a cup of coffee. Now, I said I was going to talk about some packages from the Slackware package set of A, which, if you're just joining us, we're talking about, on this show, we talk about packages that get installed on your Linux computer without you ever really thinking about it, which isn't a bad thing. It's not like they're sneaking things on there. It's just a general awareness of what is on your computer, because we only use maybe 20% of the commands half the time, so it's kind of good to know what else is available or what other commands are using in order to accomplish the wonderful things that get accomplished on a Linux box. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about this little place called Web Hosting Co-op. Now, Web Hosting Co-op, I have mentioned before, I know I have, because a listener of this very show a guy called Josh Cox is one of the people who run web hosting co-op. I didn't realize what his position was or what his placement was in the company, but he's kind of like, he's one of the main guys. And he was kind of bugging me, just like Vulcan Rider was bugging me about ZFS. Josh was kind of bugging me for a while about getting myself onto webhosting.coop. And I told him, look, it sounds great, and I fully support a nonprofit cooperative web hosting company. Like, that sounds really amazing. But at the time, I had free hosting, or I think it's at one point I lost the free hosting, but I still had, what was it? I lost the free hosting, but I still had another account that I had been paying for the past like 5 years or something. So it just would have been silly for me to migrate. So he threw a free web hosting token my way. He gave me a year free in order to try webhosting.coop. And so I finally did give it a go. The things that were keeping me from trying it earlier were really just convenience sake, you know, I mean, just bandwidth of time, really. It was just whether I had the time to sit down and dedicate time to migrating information and kind of just mentally restructure a bunch of things that I knew needed to be restructured. So webhosting.coop is something that if you are looking for web hosting, I would strongly, strongly suggest you looking into. And it's obviously easy for me to say this now because I'm on it and I'm not paying for it. That said, the experience that I've had so far makes me feel eternally guilty for not paying for it yet. And when that year of free hosting rolls around, I'm going to happily pay for my web hosting account on webhosting.coop. Because first of all, and this is, first of all, it's a cooperative. And not everyone really gets what a cooperative is, but I mean, we're all members of a cooperative. If you're listening to this show and you run Linux or BSD or Open Indiana or whatever it is, you're sort of kind of a member of a cooperative. I mean, there's some governance differences between a literal cooperative and just a community of people, but in a way, this is really a pure form of co-op, because we all sort of have ownership of this of the technology that we use, and some of us use more than we provide, and others provide more than maybe we use, but we all benefit from it. And like I say, there's governance differences there, because there's not really, we're not a co-op, because we don't meet and then make decisions and stuff like that. But I mean, some projects do. So cooperative, the concept of a cooperative in free and open source software is really, really important. It's a very significant concept, and it may take many different forms in terms of, you know, if you really drill down and see how they make decisions and so on. But it is an important concept. And I think in a sense, if you look at the internet as a whole, it started as kind of a cooperative. And certainly if not a, again, not a literal cooperative, the sense was that it was a community and a cooperative community, something, a place where people learn from one another. I mean, just think about, this is one of my favorite examples, because if you experienced this, then you know how deeply true it is. And if you have not yet experienced it, then I think luckily there's still a chance that you can experience this yourself, although a little bit less in some ways. But anyway, the thing that I'm talking about is HTML, right? How do we all learn HTML? Well, back in the early days of the internet, or I call them the early days of the internet, they're not really that early, but when I got into the internet and started getting curious about, well, how do I get on to this thing? How do I get a presence on there? You would just go to a website and you'd right-click on it or something, and you'd click View Page Source, and there's all the code right there. And so if you copied all that code and pasted it into a text editor, and made little changes, you know, where it said Bob's site, you changed it to be Plateau's site, then when you looked at that page in your web browser, it worked. And then you could experiment around. But what are these funny numbers under the colors? There's 6 digits, and I don't know what any of them mean, so I'll change a couple and see what happens. And it was that kind of very raw kind of reverse engineering, really sort of like a puzzle, I mean, a proper puzzle of where you're in a safe sort of container and you can reverse things and try it and back out of it and then try it again. And you learn like that. So that was the internet, right? And it was a very kind of cooperative sense, because it was sort of this idea that we could all learn from each other and thereby create a better space for everyone. And that's important. That's super, super important. So webhosting.coop is a proper co-op with like a governing council and everything. You've got democratic control over the organization. So that's cool. I haven't been able to take advantage of that yet, because I don't believe anything has happened with it. I mean, they have town hall meetings, but I don't believe that that's happened since I've been a member yet. But the reason I'm talking about webhosting.coop right now, rather than after another 2 or 3 or 4 months, is because, first of all, I can always talk about it again. But second of all, my experience I believe I switched over the holidays. Yeah, in fact, I did, because I was getting messages from people about how the websites were down. So I switched hosting at that time. But it was this, I was doing a fairly large campaign of kind of like, okay, I'm going to reorganize all my stuff, because people were asking me, well, hey, where did those articles go? Where did these articles go? And it was getting to the point where I felt like I needed to have a centralized location for all of the stuff that I do. So I kind of wanted to do this migration right. I wanted to do it correctly. And so I took time to do this, tried to figure out how I was going to structure the server and all the different components that I wanted to put into it. Had a couple of different ideas. And I you know, you open up an account, and then you've got your public_HTML folder, so you can SSH in there and figure that out. But I wanted to do some htaccess stuff so that I could redirect things. And I gotta admit, my Apache is pretty rusty lately, because I had, even when I was doing a lot of sysadmin work, I had switched over to Nginx for practically everything. And so I've not done a lot of the Apache specific things in a very long time. So I was trying to redirect some stuff, and eventually I finally just asked Josh to help me out. And he just, yeah, he knew exactly what to do. He was super fast, got it done really, you know, really elegantly, which I think is the main thing, right? I mean, like, I could have done it. I was getting there. It would have happened eventually, but it probably would have been a hack. And then someone who really, really knows it drops in, takes care of it, and you're up and running. Now, I realize that that sort of thing doesn't scale. And if all of you suddenly switched to webhosting.coop for your hosting provider and expected people to answer your questions really quickly and promptly and to get everything done for you and to figure out all your htaccess files, it wouldn't work, because there's only so many of them and there's so many of us. So it would, you know, eventually, is what I'm trying to say, eventually any kind of organization would sort of start to buckle under the weight of a bunch of people, and then they would have to, things would take a little bit longer to get done or whatever. So I'm not raving really about the fact that I got quick and prompt and really, really good help. I'm praising the fact that they were there and willing to help, which I know you're thinking, well, doesn't that describe any company? I mean, that's what capitalism ensures, right? That good companies rise to the top, and you go to a company and you ask for help, and suddenly, because they're a good company, there's lots of help for you. Now, I don't know what world you experience in your reality, but that has not been my experience so far, especially with web hosting. I remember days where that used to be the case, where you could call a web host and ask questions, and they would actually have answers, because all 20 people working there were actually, they knew what they were talking about, or they'd been there long enough around smart people enough that they can provide answers, or at least good guesses towards answers. And then at some point, it all kind of got migrated away to call centers, where there are scripts that people read to you, generally echoing the same questions that you called to ask in the first place. So the fact that webhosting.coop is really, really serious about being a capable and reliable provider of web hosting is really, really exciting to me. And that has been the most significant thing that I've experienced so far with webhosting.coop is just that there's real people there behind the scenes who know their stuff and who are willing to help. It may or may not take a day or two for them to get back. I don't really, it doesn't matter. But probably if I was like, I don't know, if maybe they offered a premium plan and I was super rich, I could pay a premium and get really, really fast responses or something. Who knows? Maybe that's something they're considering if they scale, if they have to scale up, that maybe that's how they would structure it. I don't know. I can't speak for them. But the point is, they're there, they're willing to help. And they know what they're talking about, and they're not farming people off to call centers. They're not sending them back automated emails with a script about, here's what you should check. Did you try to unplug it and then plug it back in, and so on. Huge, huge difference. And then another thing is that it's just been a really, really reliable service. I mean, uptime is cheap these days, but I mean just in terms of what I expect from webhosting.coop. It has been very, very, there have been no surprises, in other words. So when I'm setting up scripts to push something to webhosting.coop, it just works. And there are no gotchas. There's no surprise. We made you think that this thing is available to you, but when you started using it, then we had to block you because we didn't really think you were ever going to notice. And that literally has happened. And that was the thing that finally pushed me over the edge to sit down and get the webhosting.coop thing set up and up and running and switching over my websites to webhosting.coop, because the place that I had been with previously, I was doing some scripting on the server that I did not consider intrusive. I did not consider it against any kind of agreement or policy. And it wasn't. It was just some Git hooks. It wasn't a big deal. I was bouncing some Git repos so that I could push to a Git repo and then have that repo on the server push automatically, or actually change directory and then pull from that directory, so that I would push content to the internet and it would go live with a Git pull in a public directory. So that there was no, it's not, it's nothing. Nothing fishy here is going on. It's all very sort of non-threatening, and it's fine. There's not a problem. This should not be a problem. And I got shut out and blocked, and just all kinds of things were going wrong. So switched to webhosting.coop, and certainly that works. But that's just a single case. Again, just one thing. The bigger picture and the bigger story here is that they're honest with what they provide. They tell you exactly what your resources are, and then when you use those resources, they don't scold you for doing so. And that's quite refreshing. And they're helpful and knowledgeable, and that's super refreshing. And I realize that as I progress in knowledge about these things, I do understand that I am starting to, and this sounds really sort of really self-confident or whatever, but I think probably you experienced this as well. The day that you understood what an IP address was, and the day that you understood that you could go into your router and configure it or whatever, and then you call your internet company or whatever, and you have a question, and they start talking down to you, and now because you're smarter now, and so you think, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. I know that because I. That's how I used to talk about these things. Yeah, I'm talking to someone who is, in these issues, dumber than I am. Maybe not in life or whatever, but just in these issues, in this department, this person that I'm calling for help does not have knowledge beyond what I have. And sure, sometimes some people on the phone have knowledge about, the way that the company works, and they might be able to explain, oh, well, you're not getting that service because you need to upgrade to this package or whatever. That's great. But for the pure technological questions where you're getting sort of this first tier support or this, however they, the first tier is the lowest, I forget. But you get that sort of entry level support and you realize, oh, this is no longer support for me. This is below the tier that I am on. So as you go up in support tiers, then a lot of times the companies that you're dealing with, the effect is that they're going down. You're starting to sort of leave them behind. And webhosting.coop's not that way. They are very much on the level of any technologically sort of sound person. So if you're using Linux, you're comfortable hosting a website or a service here and there, check out webhosting.coop. Highly recommended. I think if you want to use them, contact me. I think I have a coupon for you. I think that's what Josh told me. Maybe not. Anyway, contact me if you're actually going to go over to webhosting.coop. I may have a discount for you. That sounds exciting. That's like my first giveaway on the show. That's not true. I've given other stuff away. But that's a significant one. Now, let's switch over and talk about Slackware packages. I guess this has been a little mini-series of file system stuff. I was talking about switching from JFS to X4, and then in this episode, and then I was talking about ZFS, and then I was talking about Quota in the previous episode. Remember that? I was talking about Quota. And then this time, we're going to talk a little bit, really briefly, about a file system called RiserFS. Now, RiserFS Progs is the Slackware package that we're at now. So we're Quota and now RiserFS Progs. RiserFS Progs are utilities used for RiserFS. RiserFS is a file system based on balanced tree algorithms. I don't really know what that means, but I remember, and people who've been using Linux longer than I have can probably correct me on this, but I remember it being, like, people would talk about it as the file system that had journaling. Like, that was as far as I remember, that was the thing that was exciting about RiserFS. Now, Wikipedia does confirm that RiserFS had metadata-only journaling, or also block journaling, since Linux 2.6.8, which, I mean, at the time, it would have been up against ext2, which didn't have journaling, so that would have been a pretty exciting development. It also could grow the file system while it was running, apparently, so online resizing, growth only. You couldn't shrink, I guess, but you could grow it as it was running. And then there was a scheme to reduce internal fragmentation, which I don't know anything about. So those were the big main features, according to Wikipedia. I don't know a whole lot about that historically, and I don't know a whole lot about this file system because I've never run it, and I certainly don't ever intend to run it. And frankly, I really do kind of wonder if it's even going to stick around. I mean, I'm pretty sure that a lot of the development has fallen off. I don't believe that it's going to be around for much longer. It is in the Slackware package set, however, because it was in the Slackware package set at some point, and so Slackware is quite good at backwards compatibility, and so it retains support for that file system. Next up is RPM to TGZ. Now, this one I know a lot about. I use this all the time. This is a fantastic little script. It is written by Patrick Volkerding. It was written, I guess, back in 1997. That's what the copyright notice says anyway. So this does pretty much what the name suggests, which is it takes an RPM and converts it to a TGZ, specifically a TGZ that is a Slackware package. And you must remember, it's difficult to remember this sometimes, but you must remember that a TGZ or a TBZ or a TXZ, these are just archive formats. So you can produce a TGZ, for instance, from files, you're just with the tar command, and that does not mean that it is a Slackware package. It just means that you've got an archive that has been tarred and then gzipped or rezipped or whatever. So the fact that Slackware packages use that extension, TGZ, TBZ, does not suggest that any TGZ or TBZ or TXZ is a Slackware package. It simply tells you that a Slackware package is a T question mark Z. Okay, so this will actually translate an RPM that you download from, say, Fedora, and it will unarchive the RPM, dump out all the contents somewhere temporary, and then restructure them so that they look like a Slackware archive, and then tar them up and gzip them for you, or xz. I don't know what the verb form of xz is. Xz? Zikem? Zipem? I don't know. So it will tar them up and then zip them in some form, and then you have suddenly a Slackware package. It seems almost too good to be true, and in a way it is sometimes. It does not work sometimes, but very, very frequently it does work. I use it all the time. So I'm going to go to, for instance, dl, as in download, .fedoraproject.org/pub/fedora/linux/releases. I have that bookmarked. I use this so frequently that one of the six bookmarks that I have on any of my computers, like that, all I have are six bookmarks, and they're all Slackware related except that one, which is the Fedora release repository. So I happen to know that Fedora 25 was about 2 years ago, just from memory, and I know Slackware 14.2 has got to be, well, at least that long. So I'm going to go to 25, and it looks like there's a little note here in the Fedora server saying 25 doesn't even, we don't even support that anymore. Why are you here? So it sends me off to an archive. So now I'm at pub archive Fedora, and I'll go into Linux, and I'll go into releases if I'm recalling correctly, and I'll go into 25. Yep, and here's everything. And here are the different architectures. There's x86, 64, and i386. So I'm going to go into the 64 one, and there's OS, that's what I want, and then there are packages in there, and there's a list of all the directories, so 0 through 9, and then A through Z. I'm going to go to, let's say, P for Pandoc, because this is one of the ones, this is one of the I guess, the bigger ones that I use this for, because Pandoc, if you've ever used Pandoc, it's a document converter. It's pretty handy, but it's written in Haskell, and it has so many, it has literally a gigabyte of dependencies in order to compile the thing. It compiles down, if you do it statically, to an 8.3 megabyte package. I don't know how much the executable is off the top of my head, but compiling all that just to get this one package and then never to use any Haskell again ever is a lot to ask. So I go to Fedora, I grab the pandoc-static package, and I download that. And so here it is. It's a pandoc static RPM. So I'll go over, I've just downloaded it. Now I'll go over my downloads folder, and then I will issue the command RPM2 TGZ. And that is the number 2, RPM2 TGZ. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and I'll be fancy and use the newer TXZ, and then just give it the path to pandoc-static RPM, and it converts it. This can take a long time, it can take a short time, it kind of depends. I've seen icon sets take forever because there are so many icons in an icon set. So that takes a long time, but a lot of times the ones that are, this is actually fairly quick, relatively. And so now once you've got, so if you do an ls in the directory, then you'll see that you indeed have a pandoc blah RPM and a pandoc blah TXZ. So then if I do an install, I should probably make sure that I don't actually have that installed yet. Yes, I do not have that installed yet. So now I can do an install pkg pandoc. I'm just going to do an asterisk TXZ return. And it installs it just like any other Slackware package. And now I can issue the command because it's in my path. No, it's not. Yes, it is. It's pandoc dot static, which is weird. I usually alias that later after the fact, but yeah, that's all you do. That's how you can get a package installed on your Slackware box without really having to work at it. Now, I remember, I mean, this has the same kind of issue that any kind of, just going out to the internet finding packages generally does have, which is if there's some portion of this package that you didn't know to get, then you've just installed essentially part of a package rather than the full thing. And in this case, that's exactly what's going on. So I'm getting this issue here where I don't have all of the parts of Pandoc that I actually want. And that would be, I need to also get pandoc-common and pandoc-pdf, and I may as well grab pandoc-siteproc as well. And that way I'll just have the full stack. And that's even though it is a static package, it's just, you need the support libraries that didn't get installed. And that seems a little bit strange because it's a static package, right? I mean, that's why I'm doing this. But the reason for that is because the package would still work, but for half of my uses, it's not going to be very useful because I want to do other, I want to do things that aren't installed by default into the static package. That's fine. It's just something that you have to be kind of aware of. And unlike slackbuilds.org, where it tells you, hey, this is your dependency trail, and you can resolve that. There's no such service directly here for Fedora. So you might have to do a little investigation if you decide, oh, I'm going to install, I don't know, KDE. using only RPM to TGZ. Probably not advisable, I'll admit, but I mean, you could go for it. In that case, you would have to do all that homework and figure out which different RPMs are involved in this concept of install the whole thing, and then you'd have to convert them all. So it can be a little bit of a chore. And even after I've downloaded all of these other packages, I'm still getting an error when I try to execute pandoc.static because I don't have a shared library, liblua5.1.so, can't be found. Now, I happen to know that I certainly do have Lua installed, but it looks like just looking in my usr lib64 liblua and a couple times, then liblua.so.5.1. And Pandoc apparently is looking specifically for, what did it say, liblua-5.1.so. So if I go as root, if I switch over to usr lib64, and then, oops, not less, c in there, and then I say ln --symbolic, and so then I'm going to link that to liblua5.1.so, I think is what I'm saying. Yeah, and that did it. So that frees up that error. Now, I happen to know that there's actually another thing that technically I need, but it's already installed, called libcmark. And depending, once again, because these aren't synchronized, if you get libcmark 0.28.3, which is, as of this recording, that's the current one, and this was compiled against libcmark 0.25.2, which in fact it is, then there would be a conflict there, and you'd have to decide how you wanted to resolve that. You could resolve it either by installing cmark 0.2252 and not linking it to what the more up-to-date ones usually do, which is just link themselves to libcmark.so, or you could just do a symlink again from libcmark so 0.25.2 to so.0.28.3, which is considered bad practice, but I mean, it works for me. And finally, you'd get a working pandoc, and we could test that out by saying echo hello into, let's just do a hello.txt, and then I'll do pandoc.static, and I'll just give it an input of just hello.txt, and then I'll put output hello-o hello.html, and there, now I've got a hello txt and a hello html. So in other words, it works. And it looks like, yeah, it put paragraph tags around the word hello. So there you go. That's how I get pandoc on my Slackware system, which was not the point. The point was RPM2 TGZ or TXZ is an amazing little handy package. Because I mean, that seems like a lot of work what I just did there. But believe me, compared to compiling the full Haskell tool chain, this is priceless. This is huge for me, for pandoc alone. Now, that said, it's a lot easier if I'm just going out to Fedora, for instance, to pilfer something simple like an icon set. There's a Breeze, the KDE 5 icon set is called Breeze, I think, and it's the dark theme versus Oxygen that comes with KDE 4 on Slackware. So I grab that from Fedora because it's easy to do that. You just go to wherever they keep their this icon set, which is probably in the B section, I don't know, and then you grab that RPM, run RPM to TXZ on it, it converts it. Sometimes it takes a long time because there's a lot of icons, and then you install it and you're done. That's it. No, you don't have to worry about dependencies. You don't have to go grab another, you don't have to execute anything to see what fails and then go fix it like I was doing for pandoc. It's just done. Same thing for fonts. A lot of times fonts will come really, they're super easy to find on Fedora. I say that because I know where to look. I'm just saying, like, sometimes instead of going and grabbing a font from one place, I just grab it from Fedora and install it because I can super easily just with RPM 2. TGZ. And there are lots of little examples here and there that I've stolen from Fedora. I'm not thinking of them all necessarily. And some of them are complex like pandoc. Some of them are complex and still easy, unlike pandoc. I mean, pandoc used to be easy when there was a greater alignment between where Fedora happened to be and where Slackware was. But it gets a little bit more complex the farther you stray. And that's not just the OS, because you saw in this example, I went back to 25, but see, Slackware, or the packages in Slack build specifically didn't stand still. So you've got this, you you've got this old target of 25. Your base OS is old, so you've got a good amount of overlap there. But then the add-on packages that you're adding keep progressing. So it does get complex, but depending on, you know, if it's something that you want that is just too complex to install otherwise, RPM 2 TGZ is a fantastic option. Very, very useful. It lets someone else worry about the packaging of the thing, and all you have to do is translate it. And that's the ideal. Like, this is much closer to the ideal. Don't get me wrong, it's not the ideal. But this idea of open source and there being this thing that someone else has already spent effort on, and so you go grab that, you maybe run it through a converter, and now it's ready for your use. I mean, that's wonderful. If all Linux packages had easy conversion, easier than this, easier than RPM to TGZ, where you have to go find out the dependencies and then adjust your library name, symlinks, and all that other stuff. If it was like this but streamlined, I don't think it would be a big deal that we all had different package managers and so on. It would just be, who cares? Here's an RPM. Use it on this system. And there used to be a package to do that. It was called Alien, I think. I don't really hear about that anymore. And that was specifically, I think, between RPM and Deb packages. I don't really know why that has sort of faded. I never used it, so I can't even say if it approximated, you know, if it got close to that ideal. But that would be really, really nice if we could all make that happen. And if not, let's just all switch to Flatpak and image app image, and then we'll be good to go. But that's beside the point. Point is, we're through the R's now. We know we have no more R packages in the A set. So the next thing that we'll start in some other episode is the S section within the A set. Eventually we'll get to the end of the A set. It'll be very exciting. Okay, I think that's the end of the show. So I hope you had a good time. I hope you have learned something. And thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you next time. Order Ogcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu, @mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
I'm skating. Thanks anyway.